Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
A search for the truth behind an international drug smuggling plot.
How are we going to unravel this all?
From the BBC World Service, this is World of Secrets, Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, Americans are preparing to elect a new president next week. So we want to take a look at how each of the candidates would approach a relationship with the continent. Also, Nigeria's leader Bola Tinubu is trying to convince the country to choose compressed natural gas over petrol. We're wondering if Nigerians are prepared to make the change.
Nigeria has depended so much on fossil fuel that everything now depends on fuel. So if there's an alternative, I think it's something that we can explore.
But Nigeria needs to take their time and actually test the cars powered by gas.
That sounds like a yes, but maybe to me. But we'll hear about it later. It's Thursday, the 31st of October. First, we go to Sudan. Civil society groups there are warning that women are so fearful of sexual assault as the war continues that they are prepared to take their own lives. Just a warning, there are details of sexual violence coming up.
There is text messages, you know, WhatsApp messages that was shared with us by female activists on the ground from young women within 50 villages. And those are the villages that were exposed to this campaign of retributions and killing. So they started sending messages that they are going to kill themselves. You know, knowing the RSF is actually moving towards their villages, that they cannot bear the idea of being raped and they don't have anywhere to go, so they would rather kill themselves.
Speaking there was Hala Al-Karib from the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. On Tuesday, a major United Nations report highlighted what they called staggering levels of sexual violence in Sudan, attributing the worst atrocities to the paramilitary rapid support forces. We first got wind of the situation back in September when I spoke to our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher, who had recently visited a market at a crossing point near Omdurman. She described a meeting with a group of women who had recently fled rapid support forces territory.
All of a sudden, one woman just burst out like a dam had broke. And she basically said, you know, why aren't you helping us? Why is the world not helping us? What have we done? And then she went on to say, there are so many women here who've been raped. They don't talk about it. But what difference would it make anyway? You, she said, pointing at me, in your world, if your child would go out and, you know, possibly the implication was possibly be abducted or raped because she'd been talking about girls that the RSF may keep for 5 or 6 days. She said, would you just leave her? Wouldn't you go look for her? But what can we do? We can't do anything. Nothing is in our hands. Nothing is in our hands. As she was talking, the women around her started crying. And her mother, she pointed at her mother. Her mother was sitting on the ground with her head in her hand, just sobbing. It was an extraordinary moment, really.
That's Barbara Plett-Usher talking to me back in September. BBC Africa's security correspondent is Ian Wafula, who's been following up on these reports. Many women committing suicide in Sudan. Tell us about what's happening. What's happening to women?
Well, Audrey, the last 2 days have been very difficult as I'm trying to follow up stories of women, or rather we're hearing reports of women who are either taking their own lives after being sexually abused by the RSF or are planning to do so out of fear, just because that's the last resort that they have to avoid any sexual violations by the paramilitary rapid support forces. And a lot of this is being reported happening happening in Jazeera State, where the RSF has raided about 50 villages. Now, this started last week on the 20th of October when Abu Akla Keika, an RSF commander, defected to join the Sudanese army. And obviously, as you can imagine, from a conflict point of view, this is a huge blow to the RSF. And so they were angered and decided to kind of start a revenge campaign and went on a rampage, attacking 50 villages. And through this, they have been rounding up civilians, looting and even raping women and young girls. And this is where the reports of women taking their own lives, opting to take their own lives, started coming up, Audrey.
Were you able to confirm cases, or, you know, is it anecdotal, or do we know that it's definitely happening? It's just difficult to confirm.
I can at least confirm of 4 cases. One is because I chatted with one girl who said her own sister had taken her own life. But I tried to advance this conversation, but it was difficult because it was happening over Facebook. And this girl was in Khartoum. And because of internet outages, I've not heard from her again. She literally just left a message that my sister took her own life after sexual violations by the RSF. But then I continued to follow further, and I managed to speak to Hala Al-Karib, who is the executive director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. And the organization actually documents gender-based violence against women especially. And she said that they have so far recorded 3 cases of suicide by women who were unfortunately raped by RSF soldiers. In fact, if I can go ahead to give one example, Audrey, a bit too graphic, I must say.
Maybe not the graphic detail.
One example is of a woman who was raped in front of her brother and father before the RSF went on to murder them. And therefore, she could not take at all what had just happened to her. You know, the loss of family and also being violated in front of them.
Is it happening all over Sudan? Because you're mentioning the rapid support forces and you spoke about what's happening in Al Jazeera State, but also you had an example of somebody from Khartoum. Is this widespread across Sudan, or is it specific?
When I did speak to Hala Al-Karib, she did say that it's impossible to rule out that this is happening in other parts of Sudan. It's just because it's difficult to document this because of the ongoing conflict and internet outages. However, I'd like to draw your attention to a UN report which just came out on Tuesday, and it found that Sudan's paramilitary group RSF is responsible for committing sexual violence on a large scale in areas under their control. In fact, the report went on to say that the scale of the sexual violence documented in Sudan is staggering. And the report was also rather descriptive on how some of the attacks took place, quite disturbing, as you can imagine what is happening. It did also say that men and boys have also been reportedly targeted, however, not to the scale that women and young girls have been targeted. Also to mention, Audrey, is that many victims are often targeted on the basis of their gender and or real perceived ethnicity. Now, the Sudanese armed forces have also, you know, been accused of committing sexual violence, only that it is at a smaller scale compared to the RSF. I also managed to speak to the spokesperson of the RSF, and they went on to deny these allegations in this report, and they said that the UN is relying on activists or officials who are aligned to the Sudanese armed forces, Audrey.
The head of the Sudanese armed forces, General Burhan, has also accused the RSF of committing genocide. What sort of evidence do you think he has to make that case?
Well, it's difficult to say, but then I would go back to what the United States and also the UN have reported before, where they've said, for instance, the RSF have carried out what looks like a genocide, especially in Darfur, similar to a situation where we saw the RSF do this about 20 years ago when they were known as the Janjaweed. And, you know, there were cases of ethnic cleansing, especially against people who did not support or who did not come from the same community as them. And I would imagine that this is the same evidence that General Al-Burhan is basing his sentiments from.
Of course, we will remember that the Janjaweed were actually a paramilitary force under the control of the Sudan armed forces. Things have come to a pretty pass, haven't they?
Yeah, certainly. And now we've come to a point where the Sudan conflict is, you know, we're looking at more than 10 million people who have been displaced and 2.1 million others who have fled the country. And in fact, more worrying is that the head of the World Food Programme, Audrey, warned that the largest humanitarian crisis ever on the planet will occur if a ceasefire between the warring parties is not agreed, because we're looking at more than 25 million people being in urgent need of food, Audrey.
Because at the moment, people can't plant, they can't harvest or anything like that. How are people surviving?
Yeah, it's actually quite difficult. I mean, humanitarian organizations are trying as much as possible to deliver aid to the communities here. And at one point, we actually had the two warring sides kind of stopping the delivery of humanitarian aid because they felt as though that the routes that were being used to deliver aid also being used to deliver weapons. And so they decided to stop the delivery of humanitarian aid. And these are just the kind of challenges that the country is facing, especially, you know, women and children who are also caught up in the war, Audrey.
That's the BBC Africa security correspondent, Ian Wafula. The United States presidential election is looming, and it is dominating the news agenda around the world. You may have seen social media clips of the two leading candidates calling each other out on this or that. It's sometimes entertaining, other times alarming, especially when the conversation involves migration. But African leaders and policymakers will be looking closely at what the candidates may be planning to do when it comes to the continent. From foreign aid and economic policies to security partnerships and climate commitments, the results will influence key areas across the continent. Let's hear a perspective from a Ghanaian analyst.
My perspective on the main impact the U.S. election could have on Africa largely, and most importantly on my home country, Ghana, depending on who wins, the first is tax code, the second is government spending, the third is international trade, and then we have immigration and regulatory policies. Now, as we speak, if the Republicans take power through President Trump, these five critical anchors, in my opinion, are going to see some variation, and it has implication on Ghana. For example, if you look at the Republican posture on government spending, and you look at the policy announcement and pronouncement of President Trump, then you should expect that there's going to be some cuts on government spending on Africa. If you look at another on trade, immigration, and regulatory policies, you will notice that trade is going to stay, meaning the status quo is going to hold. So things like the Africa Growth Opportunity Act, which is AGOA, is likely not to change because that policy is the same on both the Republican side and the Democratic side. But if you look at immigration is going to see a south turn because of the policy stance of the Republicans. And so the point I am making in terms of impact is that if you pick these five critical macroeconomic consequences, about three are going to change southward when it is the Republicans winning the election. Now, if the Democrats should win with Vice President Harris, then it appears the status quo will stay. And so nothing will change on tax code towards Africa and Ghana specifically. Government spending would be same. Trade, immigration, and regulatory policies will stay.
That's Richmond Frimpong in Ghana. Now let's take a wider look across the continent with Shem Owino Otieno, a BBC monitoring journalist based in Nairobi.
And let me start by saying that AGOA has been crucial to the trade partnership between Africa and the US. 32 out of 54 African countries currently benefit in terms of exports of apparel and textiles and agricultural products. This has been influential in sort of raising revenues for African countries that need that. But in the event that it is discontinued, I think many African countries will need to pursue trade partnerships with the US. And that would take diverse forms. And it would also mean certain continuing discussions, like, for example, Kenya has been having talks with the US. The US Trade Secretary has been visiting Kenya for a while to try and harmonize or enter into a proper agreement. There have been concerns about corruption and other things during these talks. But this is the kind of partnership we'll be looking at in the event that AGOA is discontinued. But also to just say that the Biden administration has removed at least 8 countries, Ethiopia, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Uganda, Niger, and Gabon from AGOA for concerns about governance. Some of the countries I mentioned actually had coups. But let me also just say that discontinuing AGOA might be detrimental to the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, which has been seen as complementary to AGOA in terms that this is a program through which African countries want to trade within themselves. But then doing that would mean harmonizing regulatory frameworks, which would then be also instrumental for AGOA. So I think by and large, there would be realignment of country interests with U.S. interests and whatever losses that might come out of lack of access to American markets.
We're the party of common sense because it's really more common sense than anything else. We want borders. We want fair elections. We want honest elections. And if you don't have those two things, you don't have a country, really.
Let's talk about the U.S.'s military presence, its political and diplomatic interventions in various parts of the continent. We're looking at Sudan. The conflict there has been going on for more than a year. Ethiopia, Tigray, that conflict there has ended, but the region is still in flux. And then, of course, there's the Sahel, which is very much seen as part of the U.S.'s sort of military and security backyard because of the threat of Islamist insurgencies there. Are we seeing a lack of attention, or will attention be refocused on those regions, on those conflicts, or will the new president just have way too much in their in-tray to be looking around at other things happening? Because, we have Ukraine, and we also have the war in Gaza, which is consuming a lot of political and diplomatic attention.
What we see with the U.S. military presence is that I think the U.S. sees it as its presence on the continent as a deterrence to militant groups and counterinsurgency efforts that would harm its national security interests and those of its partners on the continent. But there's also the U.S. military presence as a deterrence to, you know, the big powers of Russia and China, and the other middle powers like Turkey, which are increasingly being influential in the African continent. Now, whatever the outcome, I think we have seen a diminished U.S. presence in the Sahel. In August, U.S. removed all of its troops from Niger at the request of the Niger government following the coup that removed Mohamed Bazoum, who was a staunch or a close ally of the U.S. We've seen the U.S. move out of Chad. But even with that movement out of Chad as well, we've seen reports in the local media suggesting that the U.S. might be moving those assets out of Chad and Niger into Benin and Cote d'Ivoire. So we see a potential presence for the U.S. military in those areas. I think by and large, when some of the junta countries in the Sahel, Burkina Faso, Mali, remove the West, that is the French, from their countries, has been filled by Russia. You know, Russia's come in very big and it's become a preferred security partner. So I think in that sense, the U.S. would still want to maintain some presence. We've seen the U.S. in Somalia through the U.S. Africa Command supporting security efforts there. But let me also talk about the Sudan. We did see the Geneva talks involving the RSF, which is fighting the Sudanese army. They didn't go really well because the army said they could not join it. But in the absence of the U.S. presence, again, the UAE and Saudi Arabia have become very big players in Sudan. So what we're seeing here is the importance of the U.S. as a security partner for some of these countries is diminishing. But depending on whether it's Harris, if it's Harris, we expect that they might want to entrench themselves. You know, Harris, when she went to Ghana, I think last year, she announced $100 million for frontline states. And this is basically for counter-extremism activities. So we might see more of the U.S. presence there. Now, Trump, when he was president, wanted, you know, very limited U.S. presence, especially troop presence on the continent. And he'd been a bit hawkish in terms of whether the U.S. should involve itself, even in U.N. peacekeeping missions. So a Trump presidency might, you know, return to that very distant isolationist stance.
And I pledge to always put country above party and self, and to be a president for all Americans.
We've spoken about Russia and in the context of sort of military competition, security competition. China, of course, offers trade competition. How are African countries navigating U.S.-China tensions? And are African leaders able to negotiate advantageous deals for themselves and their countries and their citizens based on that competition?
I think we can see from the Forum on Africa Cooperation that happened in Beijing in September that many African countries see China as a good trade and economic ally. And China, it may be winning the war in terms of narratives. China comes to Africa and says, we are going to do win-win partnership. You know, we're going to give you funding based on your needs. And it has done very many mega projects across the continent. So African countries which need infrastructure, whether they are power plants or whether they are, you know, roads and other infrastructure, and they see China as a country that will then deliver in terms of funding and in terms of building those infrastructure. Sometimes African countries appreciate the fact that they could go and then get into those deals. Now, the question is whether they get fair deals. And I think that is still debatable. Now, the U.S., I think, is getting onto it. If we see the U.S. is now investing in this big infrastructure project, the Lobito Corridor Development Railway Plan, which would move from Angola to DR Congo to Zambia. And during the UN General Assembly, Tanzania entered into the same agreement. So this would move from the port of Lobito in Angola all the way to the Ndola city in Zambia, the mining town of Kolwezi, DR Congo.
And then on to?
And then to Tanzania with the Dar es Salaam port.
Let's talk about fossil fuels and renewables. It's a very big debate. Africa is very much at the center of that, given that so much oil and gas is produced on the continent, but also renewables. And at COP last year, there was a lot of focus on funding renewables. Let's take a look at the two candidates and how their policies might affect that debate on the continent.
You know, climate issue is a very important aspect for African countries. Africa is disproportionately affected by, you know, the climate shocks. We've seen this year alone, there's been floods in the Sahel, in Mali, Niger, that has killed hundreds of people. Again, if you're talking about energy, some estimates say that nearly half of the continent does not have electricity, and fossil fuels are a big part of that energy mix. I think African countries that produce oil, Nigeria, for example, are very adamant that they will have to use their oil for development. And then that transition to renewables has to be in a manner that recognizes their unique situation in terms of oil and gas being very important for their economies. In terms of either candidate, if Harris continues, we expect that some of those policies will not go too far. So there would be more requirement for African countries like Nigeria, for instance, to move cleaner energy. But with Trump, we saw that, you know, he's not too keen on imposing certain restrictions or demands on moving away from, say, oil and other of the fossil fuels. I do want to say that I think a very important need for African countries is climate financing. African countries do want, you know, the bigger global powers to commit or to deliver on their commitments for climate financing.
Who do you think of the two is likely to visit African countries in the next administration?
I think Kamala Harris already visited Tanzania, Ghana, Zambia, Ghana as well. So it's possible that Kamala Harris might, you know, come to Africa. I mean, Trump famously called Africa something I won't mention. But yeah, I don't think that Trump would be more interested in on the African continent.
That was Shem Owino Otieno from the BBC's monitoring service in Nairobi. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Let's turn our focus now to Nigeria, one of Africa's leading oil producers. President Bola Tinubu is promoting compressed natural gas, or CNG, as a cheaper, cleaner alternative to petrol. He says it'll help motorists cut fuel costs by up to 80% and reduce carbon emissions. These are laudable aims. So his government is giving out free CNG conversion kits and setting up training centers. But there are safety concerns, even though experts have warned them to use only professionally made and installed units. Compressed natural gas is being used more and more in countries like Egypt. Nigeria is still lagging behind. What do Nigerians feel about this new initiative from their president?
I think that it's something that we ought to try, because Nigeria has depended so much on fossils and fuel that everything now depends on fuel. So if there's an alternative source of energy, I think it's something that we can explore. Just I don't trust the country, so it might still explode and I'll not enter.
I feel it is a good alternative, similar to how, like, in foreign countries, they've switched, like, from gas to electricity. Like, with the current fuel prices, it's better, like, you pay for gas a lot cheaper. But for now, I don't think, like, Nigeria needs to, like, take their time and actually test the cars, like, powered by gas.
I think the fact that they are not manufactured already made like that is an issue for me, because that just means that every single car that will be converted to CNG, some will be converted well and some will not. It's just too risky. It's better to just start purchasing cars that were already like designed for CNG.
Those voices from Lagos. And I must confess that I didn't know what compressed natural gas actually was and why one of the biggest oil producing countries on the continent would be promoting it. I didn't know any of that until I spoke to Increase Olua Kayode Osorun, who's an automobile specialist who has worked on CNG conversion cars in Nigeria. What exactly is compressed natural gas and how does it differ from petrol?
Okay, compressed natural gas is a primary composed of a Meltac CH performance. It is a clean burning fuel system. It produces a green environment emission system. Compressed natural gas produces fuel emission system to contribute to low air pollution system for the environment. And what I'm saying is, in essence, is it produces a green environment, a clean air above the PMS, which is a petrol. If you're using a compressed natural gas, you have a clean environment.
So
the emission is there.
So it's natural gas. It's not petrol.
Yeah, it's not petrol. It's a natural gas. That is why it was compressed. You cannot compress a petrol.
So how is it delivered? Do you have to go to a petrol station or a station where you then put it into your car or what?
There is a cylinder that is designed for it. The cylinder is right inside your trunk. So when you get to the gas station, there's a dispense area for compressed natural gas. They refill it the way they refill the house cooking gas. So when you get to the gas station, they'll dispense it from their nozzle into your cylinder. From your cylinder, that is where you get a dispense to the firing order of your automobile.
Is it cheaper than petrol? Besides the fact that it's cleaner than petrol, is it safer than petrol? Besides the fact that it's cheaper than petrol?
It's cheaper than petrol, yes. It's cleaner than petrol, yes. But the performance are two different performance. Safety is the number one key. PMS, petrol, is more safe than compressed natural gas.
In what way and why?
The construction of compressed natural gas is meant to be in an airtight environment where there shouldn't be any leakage from any path. Because the minute you have a leakage of a compressed natural gas, be rest assured that there will be an explosion if it's not well taken care of. And if they don't give it a good attention on time, it will explode and cause a strong damage. But a PMS can be leaking, which is petrol. A petrol can be leaking without bringing a flame. But compressed natural gas is not like that.
Right, because there are actually safety concerns, right, around it and people using it in Nigeria, or rather people that have been using free compressed natural gas conversion kits have been worried because there have been recent explosions linked to makeshift kits. So what has caused these explosions? Is it by the nature of the fact that it is a compressed natural gas canister, or is it because people have been installing them willy-nilly?
The problem here is the government are meant to put some measures in place concerning the safety of compressed natural gas before they start converting their vehicle. And all of this are not in place. They said they have a designated place for conversion. And I said, if you want to introduce compressed natural gas for the citizen of Nigeria here, what you need to do is to educate them for like 5 years and be sure that every canister that retains the gas is a direct canister for it. The flip valve is is the one that they can switch between compressed natural gas and petrol. And the steel that they'll use for conversion should be the real steel for the conversion. So if all of this is done, it will be a safe environment for it. But the regulation and the standard establishment of compressed natural gas are not duly followed. Everyone that has their money to go and buy the complete kit for conversion, just go there and buy their conversion and give it to someone that said he knows how to do it. And majority of the people converting in here, they are just converting it because of the money, not because of the safety. Because majority of them don't know what a safety is. The regulation standing behind safety, they don't know it. It's not everybody that is converting it that have a train that has trained and well certified.
That's dangerous for people who have a can-do attitude and are motivated by cost factors. What can the government do to stop people from doing that? Because as more people start using it, it may very well become a real serious safety hazard on Nigerian roads. Not that there are not enough hazards on Nigerian roads as we speak.
I've done what I do as a specialist for 22 years, two decades plus. You know, the system the Nigerian government have is not the right system for the compressed natural gas. What I see with the Nigerian government is they want to sell the product, they want to impose a product on the citizen of Nigeria without thinking about the safety. Number one, inspection protocol need to be carried out. Number two, public awareness campaign is meant to be on for like 2-3 years. Because they start to talk about compressed natural gas now for less than 8 months, 9 months, 10 months. Then infrastructure development must meant to be in place. And number five, they have to have the emergency response plan.
Increase Oluwakayode Osorun, automobile specialist with knowledge of CNG conversion cars in Nigeria. Focus on Africa was put together by Victor Silva, Nyasha Michelle and Bella Hassan here in London. Blessing Aderogba soldiered on from Lagos. Joseph Keane was the senior journalist in charge. Nick Rundell was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudenge, our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. And until next time, thanks for listening.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news. With insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.